A vicious cycle today on the world. I'm Carol Hills. The U.S. and South Korea respond to North Korea's test of a new missile. And so the escalation continues.
North Korea keeps improving its missiles because we keep threatening it. And in many ways, this is a vicious cycle.
Does the Trump administration have a plan to break out of that cycle?
There is no plan. There is no doctrine. There is no strategy. There are a set of impulses and tweets.
Plus, a young undocumented immigrant returns to Mexico and faces a whole new set of challenges.
Here in Mexico, we have to look for the opportunities. It's not as easy as over there. You have to literally fight for a space in a college.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. Glad you could be with us today. We're going to be talking about Volvo going electric and cows going rogue. But we still have North Korea on our minds. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said today that North Korea's new test launch of a long-range missile represents an escalation of threat to us here in the U.S. But how much? We decided to check back in with David Kang. He's director of the Korean Studies Institute at the University of Southern California. We've talked to him in the past about Korea, nuclear deterrence, and his father, who came to the U.S. from what later became North Korea. David, U.S. officials say the missile test is an escalation of the threat posed by North Korea. Is it really?
Well, in some ways, it gives North Korea better capabilities, but I don't think it makes North Korea any more threatening. They already have been able to do extensive damage in the region, and this only makes it more obvious that they can do that damage. But in some ways, I think we inflate the threat. North Korea is responding to an awful lot of chest thumping by the United States, and both sides, I think, are deterred from actually starting war.
Does North Korea's latest missile test add any new dimension to its strategy of deterrence, which is how it describes its nuclear program?
North Korea keeps improving its missiles because we keep threatening it, and in many ways, this is a vicious cycle. We think we need to pressure North Korea more. They take it as threats. They threaten us more, and we threaten them more. But ultimately, deterrence holds for both sides. We don't attack North Korea because we know that they can hit Japan or South Korea. They don't attack Japan or South Korea because they know they would be wiped out. It's not good, but it's stable.
Then what's the right strategy with North Korea?
Well, I think the biggest problem that we have in the United States is that we think that North Korea is a problem that's going to be solved and it's going to go away. That somehow either sanctions or pressure or engagement in trade and somehow North Korea will disappear. But it's not going away. We've waited for 20 years for this country to evaporate and to dissolve and collapse, and it's not happening. I don't think there's anything that will solve the nuclear problem.
Now, China and Russia are pushing for talks with North Korea. What do they want from North Korea and the U.S.?
I think what China and Russia have been saying clearly to the United States has been that the pressure is not going to get North Korea to back down. That's not going to work. And when you're in a hole, the best thing to do is to stop digging. Talks aren't necessarily going to do anything that's going to make North Korea to solve. Like I said, I don't think the problem is easily solved. But North Korea is a real country that we have to live with. And that's a really, really difficult lesson to be learned in the United States. Nobody wants to hear that. And what China and Russia are telling us is we need to find a way to live with North Korea. The good news is they'll be deterred. They're not going to attack us. That's the good news. They're not actually that much of a threat. The bad news is we have to live with them, and they are a human rights tragedy. But maybe we can work on that instead.
You've talked to us before about your father's journey to the U.S. from North Korea and your own hopes for reunification. What was your reaction to this?
For those of us who sort of know Korea and follow it, the ICBM test is not a surprise. It's been coming down the pike. So this is a small step. It's incremental, but it's not a game changer. Probably the biggest move was 11 years ago with the first nuclear test in 2006. Everything after that has been incremental. You know, what would be a new game changer? It's hard to say. The other thing I would say is that I was a lot more optimistic about unification 20 years ago than I am today. I don't say this happily, but I think North Korea is not about to collapse. And so we have to take it for what it is, which is a country that is threatened and is dangerous, but can be deterred.
David Kang is the director of the University of Southern California's Korean Studies Institute. Thanks, David.
My pleasure.
Joseph Cirincione is president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation. David Kong there was arguing pretty fiercely that North Korea is not a real threat to the United States. His reasoning is that Pyongyang would never launch a first strike since the regime would be quickly obliterated. Do you agree?
Well, he does have a point. However ruthless and brutal Kim Jong-un is to his own people, he's not suicidal. However, that does not mean they're not a threat. A nuclear-armed North Korea would still pose an uncertain challenge, unlikely to attack the United States first, but by no means an impossible scenario. That's why for decades, both Republicans and Democratic presidents have tried to prevent this eventuality.
Now, North Korea has been, a pain among other things. North Korea has been this kind of looming threat. Some people are arguing, why can't the U.S. just set about regime change while there's time?
Well, that's a pipe dream. That pursuing that is a path to failure. The idea that somehow you can strangle the North Korean regime or wait out this hermit kingdom has been something that American policymakers have tried for decades. They pursued that one way or the other. It has failed. This is an entrenched regime. It shows no signs of collapse, no signs of weakening. In fact, the North Korean economy is growing. So there is no way to coerce North Korea into compliance or collapse. So even though you'd like to find a military solution, a sanctions solution, a China, please take care of this for us solution, none of these show any sign of working. And that leaves you with the least bad option, which is negotiations.
What's there to negotiate?
A freeze on North Korea's program.
Well, what would you offer them in exchange for a freeze? Is it, we won't do sanctions? What is there to put on the table?
You'd offer them what they want, security and prestige. Those are the two main reasons countries have pursued nuclear programs over the last 70 years. So if the nuclear missiles are to secure the regime, you offer them security assurances. This is what was on the table in the 1990s and in 2000. The George W. Bush administration agreed to this, but the negotiations broke down.
But what does that look like practically on the table?
Practically, that looks like what they've said they want, a suspension of the South Korean and U.S. military exercises that we conduct routinely just to the south of their border. So they will freeze their nuclear program if we freeze these joint exercises. That's problematic. We don't want to do that. That is a mainstay of our defense commitments to South Korea. But there may be in there a slicing and dicing of this, maybe a reduction of those exercises, an elimination of the decapitation strikes that we exercise regularly, coupled with security assurances and a path towards achieving what the North Koreans say they want, a peace treaty with the United States, one that would finally end the Korean War.
What you're proposing requires kind of deft negotiations and diplomacy. Do you see the Trump administration as being capable of that?
God, I hope so. But it's really problematic. This is a president that's basically home alone. They haven't appointed any of the kind of personnel that would know what they're doing, that have experience. So, for example, we don't have a negotiator, an ambassador to South Korea right now. We don't have an assistant secretary for nonproliferation at the State Department, an assistant secretary for East Asia at the State Department or at the Department of Defense. We don't have any of the people who would know what they're doing here to actually undertake these kinds of negotiations. So it's problematic. One of the things this crisis reveals is that when you take a close look at the foreign policy, the national security policy of the Trump administration, there is nothing there. There is no plan. There is no doctrine. There is no strategy. There are a set of impulses and tweets.
Joe Cirincione is president of the Plowshares Fund. He's also the author of Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me on.
They'll likely be talking about North Korea at the G20 in Germany at the end of the week. But what a lot of people are wondering about is that meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin on Friday. It'll be their first face-to-face. We have Charles Maines on the line. He's based in Moscow. Charles, how significant is this meeting?
Well, it is significant, of course. As you know, these two haven't met before. It's a little bit strange in some ways because Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, you know, the heads of these major countries, have only talked twice on the phone since Donald Trump was elected. So this will be the first chance for these two to just suss each other out. And they're two kind of macho type leaders. So I think people expect it should be interesting.
Yeah, both of these leaders are known for using strong body language, especially to intimidate their adversaries. How do you envision this sit down playing out?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, you know, Trump's known for sort of the awkward power handshake. Mr. Putin is known for sort of the kind of gangster sitting style that he does during negotiations. I think one thing is that I'm curious certainly about is just to see how much access the press actually gets to these two.
What issues do you expect the two sides to bring to the table?
Well, you know, obviously we know that there's so much attention on that Mr. Trump is under so much pressure to address this election hacking issue. That, of course, is the one that probably neither leader really wants to talk about. I think you can imagine just how awkward that might be to ask Mr. Putin about election meddling by the Russian side that essentially benefited Mr. Trump. So, but certainly from the Russian side, they're eager to talk about Syria, where both sides, the Americans and the Russians, have talked about trying to essentially join forces in taking on the Islamic State there, but of course have fallen kind of on different sides of the fence on, well, relative to the future of the Syrian leadership, Bashar al-Assad in particular. That's one. Certainly they're going to be interested in Ukraine, where the Russians really bristled at the reception that Donald Trump gave to Petro Poroshenko, the Ukrainian president in Washington. This was timed maybe accidentally, maybe not, with the extension of more sanctions against Russian entities over the annexation of Crimea. That didn't go over well, and so certainly that's one issue that they'll be talking about. Of course, as you mentioned in your lead, also North Korea. This is where the Russians and the Chinese essentially are taking the lead, saying that they can be mediators between North Korea and the U.S. and South Korea on this missile crisis unfolding.
Should we expect any formal deals or any diplomatic gestures from either side?
Well, I think it's really hard to know. I mean, you know, I think going into it, certainly if you looked at what the portrayal from Moscow has been, it's been that don't expect too much. That, you know, they've been sort of burned from the last 5 months of the Trump administration, where they obviously came in to the White House promising this new relationship with Russia. It hasn't happened. And the Russians think it's because essentially the White House has been hijacked by these Russia-related scandals. They think that Donald Trump essentially can't do what he wants to do because of entrenched interests in Washington, whether that's from the Democratic opposition or that's from Cold War line thinking Republicans or what they like to call the deep state here. So all these things have kind of influenced what they think is possible with the Trump administration. But still, you have to sit down at some point and talk face to face. And this does give them a chance to try and build on something.
This meeting is getting a lot of attention here in the U.S. What's the view from Russia?
Well, they're interested. They're curious. I think that the Russians wanted this meeting for a long time, and they've had to kind of wait for it. So I think they're certainly pleased that it's finally happening, if not overdue. On the other hand, I think there is a sense that they've watched so much kind of chaos come out of this White House over the past 5 months that to really expect some kind of breakthrough is unlikely, unless, and I've heard this from several political analysts, unless this is all a smokescreen. In fact, these two are going to go big and launch, you know, announce something that they've been working on behind the scenes, unawares to us all.
The world's Charles Maines. Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
Coming up, Turks take a long march against their government. It's on the world. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. We may be in the midst of our own political turmoil, but take a look at what's happening in Turkey for a moment. For 3 weeks now, thousands of people have been on the march across the country, protesting against President Erdogan and his government. Here's my BBC colleague, Mark Lowen.
It began as a protest after an opposition MP was jailed for allegedly leaking state secrets to a newspaper. But it's become an uprising against President Erdogan and what people here see as the erosion of democracy.
We are not happy in our country. We don't have any hope.
What is wrong with the country at the moment?
Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
I've met a mother and a daughter, Turkish, but who live in London, yes?
Yeah.
And have you come from the UK just for this?
Yes, we have. It's sad to see such a beautiful country go back in time.
Ah, this lady's telling me that her son is a journalist and he's been arrested. He's been in prison for 10 months.
He's accused of insulting the president and trying to topple the government because of his opposition views. He faces 2 life sentences.
It's almost a year since the attempted coup when rebel soldiers bombed buildings and drove tanks into civilians, killing more than 260. Since then, 50,000 people have been arrested and 140,000 dismissed or suspended in a nationwide purge. Ulaş Bayraktar was, until April, a university professor, but he was fired for criticising the government's policies in Kurdish areas.
We are approaching to the deep bottom, like in the sea. If your feet touch the bottom, you can just rise up very quickly and very easily.
This march was launched by opposition leader Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. And he says, this is just the beginning.
We want to make Turkey civilized, with justice, not with MPs, journalists and academics in prison. We'll continue our fight until we get democracy and the authoritarian regime collapses.
President Erdogan has slammed the march, saying it supports terrorist groups. That hard rhetoric has rubbed off on his supporters, like passerby Hakan Murat. Justice is through the courts, he tells me, not by inciting people on the streets.
Protests have come and gone here over the years. The opposition is fractured. But now a simple walk across Turkey has given some people a glimmer of optimism that there might be an alternative road ahead.
The BBC's Mark Lowen reporting from the Justice March in Turkey. Last year, Isabella Alexander spent some time at the border that separates Spain and Morocco. It's in northern Africa where Spain has 2 tiny enclaves. Alexander is an anthropologist, writer, and filmmaker, and she went to the border to find out what life was like for the thousands of African migrants trying to get to Europe. She followed one young migrant who goes by the name Bambino. He's 14. Last year, he tried to get over the razor wire border fences and failed. Now, Isabella Alexander has an update to his story.
Bambino made it. He was a success story. He broke with the brotherhood that he was living with. As you might remember from the original story, they tended to cross in large groups, 100, 200, 300 strong, and Bambino instead decided to try to evade the border guards on the other side by crossing with just one friend. Bambino's now in a detention center in Melilla.
So he's in Melilla now, the Spanish enclave in northern Morocco. But take us back to where you first met him when he was behind the razor wire fences. What was life like for Bambino and his friends back there?
So when I first met Bambino, he was 12 years old. He had just recently arrived to one of these hundreds of camps that are hidden in the mountains in northern Morocco around the enclaves of Melilla and Ceuta. He had just survived what is a treacherous and long journey, almost 3,000 miles long by foot and hidden in the back of smugglers' cars to get from his home in the Congo to this final border crossing into Europe that they find in northern Morocco. In the camp that he lived in, there were just over 100 boys. A large majority of them were unaccompanied minors like Bambino. And the chief of the group, a man named Dikembe, who was the elder among them, had just turned 25. Their life there really centered around training for what they call the crossing, or their attempt to enter into these enclaves.
You mentioned Bambino comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Why did he leave there?
That's right. He's originally from a small town in the DRC, and he lost both of his parents when he was just 12 years old. And as is common in these communities, being the eldest child, it is his expectation at that point to take care of his younger siblings. He talks about how in his community he had no way to do that, and so he traveled to a larger city in search of work and, again, found no possibilities. He kept traveling north until he reached this final border crossing, still carrying this dream that he would be able to provide a better life for the siblings that he had left behind. For a lot of those kids who are coming from places like the DRC, Sierra Leone, Côte d'Ivoire, you often hear narratives of parents lost in war and them seeing no future beyond military conscription.
So he makes it all the way to northern Morocco. You catch up with him in this camp. And as you said, they spend a lot of time preparing to cross over these wire fences. How do they actually train for it?
They do. It's fascinating. It's like they're training for an elite military mission. You have the leader of the camp who's running drills with the young boys. One thing they do is construct these sort of makeshift ladders that they use to propel themselves over what's now 3 rings of 20-foot-high razor wire fences. Without any supplies, their ladders are made from fallen tree limbs and T-shirts that they rip apart to turn into rope. I have some amazing images of Bambino, who's called Bambino by the rest of the brothers because he's so scrawny for his age. He's not only the youngest in the group, but he's a tiny kid. And you see him doing pull-ups on tree limbs out there with Dikembe under him.
So now that he's made it, he's in this Spanish enclave. What are the conditions at the detention center where he's being held?
So I was curious to see myself. This is a space that foreign journalists haven't been able to access before, and there's really not much information out there about what the conditions are like. I wasn't able to get into the detention center, but I did eventually convince one of the guards to let me speak with him for a couple of minutes outside the gates. What he had to share was really heartbreaking. He talks about how, because there's such a small minority of boys coming from sub-Saharan Africa, while there's hundreds of boys coming from North African countries, there's a lot of abuse at the hands of other detainees. He talks about how the guards, who are North African themselves, place bets on the North African detainees beating up the boys coming from the sub-Saharan continent. What was really most heart-wrenching for me, though, was to hear him talk about how they mark the wall in order to keep track of the number of days and weeks and months that they spend in there. I think one of the hardest things is just not knowing.
So at this point, Bambino's there. He's been there for a number of months, and he could be there for years. Does he have any regrets about the crossing?
You know, he told me this isn't the Europe I expected to find. I think the boys, you know, you can imagine spending years of your life traveling thousands and thousands of miles and sustaining untold abuses at the hands of smugglers and guards and police officers along the way, all with this dream of reaching Europe, a place where you will, for the first time in your life, be guaranteed some basic human rights, and finding this on the other side.
Isabella Alexander is an anthropologist, writer, and filmmaker. She's been writing about the migrants trying to cross from Morocco into some Spanish enclaves in the northern part of the country. Thanks, Isabella.
Thank you.
Head over to PRI.org to see a photo of the emotional moment when Isabella and Bambino meet again. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, a seriously strange-looking musical instrument.
People always say the same thing, you know. Oh, it's a UFO. Or, is that a wok? You know, can you cook in that thing?
Hard to find, but easy to play. It's the handpan, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Of the many migrations happening around the world, one that doesn't get much attention is the journey African migrants make across Egypt into Israel. Tens of thousands have made the trip. So the Israeli government came up with a plan to deal with the asylum seekers. It started a secret program to encourage them to go away. Andrew Green conducted a year-long investigation for Foreign Policy magazine. Andrew, this whole process is pretty complicated. As a way to explain it, tell us about the man you met, whom you call Samin.
Yes, so I met Afi Samin in the capital of Uganda, Kampala, which was really the tail end of his journey. It started, he fled Eritrea and ended up in Israel many years ago and worked there for 7 years. But he came in at a time when tens of thousands of African refugees were coming into Israel via Egypt, and the Israeli government was starting to feel as if they were being overwhelmed by the number of new arrivals. So they basically tried to create a system to encourage the African asylum seekers to leave the country. And that started with the creation of a detention center in the desert called Holot.
Now, in your article, you talk about how Samin had been able to stay in Israel by checking in every several months with immigration. So at some point he checks in and then they take him to this detention camp?
Exactly. He just got a notice that said he had a few days to get all of his stuff together and move to this camp. And he was basically told that he could be held there indefinitely. And then several months into his stay in Holot, he was contacted by officials at the camp who told him that there was another option if he didn't want to stay. He could take a transfer to a third country. He was told it was a country in East Africa. He would arrive there, be given refugee status, have the right to work, and he would get $3,500 in addition to a one-way ticket.
So they were essentially offering a somewhat permanent placement in a third country and saying that all of this is taken care of, you'll have permission, and it'll be legal for you to stay there and live there.
Exactly, which for Ify was exactly what he was looking for. You know, he had no real attachment to Israel. He was just looking for a place where he wasn't going to be forced into military service as he had been in Eritrea, where he could just work and have a job and set up a life.
So he agrees to go. They fly him to Rwanda. And what happens next?
So before he left, he had been told that by the Israeli authorities that when he landed in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, he would be given all the paperwork he needed, including refugee status. But then when he landed, a man met Ify along with the 11 other Eritreans he traveled with, and he took their paperwork that they'd been given in Tel Aviv, and then he led them around the immigration services at the airport. So they never got anything stamped. They never got any official documentation that they had arrived in Rwanda. And that's when he really started to get nervous. And then at that point, they were taken to a house where this man who had picked them up at the airport told them that they had a choice. Either they could live permanently in this house, not be allowed to work, or they could sneak into Uganda illegally. He would charge them some money to do that. He would take them to the border. He would drop them off. And then they would basically just be, you know, on their own.
So you're saying as soon as he arrives in Rwanda with the other Eritreans, they bypass immigration, taken to this house, he's being advised to go to Uganda illegally.
Exactly. You know, less than 24 hours after he's arrived in the country where he's supposed to, you know, be setting up his new life, he's being told, never mind, none of the things we promised you are actually going to come to pass. And we're going to charge you money to illegally smuggle you into Uganda, where you will have no papers and you will have no refugee status and you will have none of the things that the Israeli authorities told you that you were going to have.
And through your research, you realize there are other people like him, but they're being sent to other countries.
Right. So there are two main groups of asylum seekers who made their way to Israel. You have the Eritreans, but then also a cohort of Sudanese, especially survivors of the genocide in Darfur. So the Eritreans are sent to Rwanda and the Sudanese are sent to Uganda. And in Uganda, when the Sudanese arrive, they're being faced with the exact same system, except they're being encouraged to either go to South Sudan or even back to Sudan itself, which can be incredibly dangerous for many of them because they're, you know, escapees of a genocide. Some of them are seen as political enemies of the regime still in Khartoum. So they're being put at risk by the system.
So in all your reporting, you found a whole bunch of Africans who have been through this process in slight variations, but essentially the same thing. What is the evidence that this is an organized program and the Israeli government knows about it?
So that's the real crux of the issue. I spoke to officials in Israel, Rwanda, and Uganda, and all of them deny any knowledge of this system existing. But I also managed to track down some people who were involved in the process of pressuring the African asylum seekers to leave Uganda, including one man who seemed to have been hired by the Ministry of Internal Affairs in Uganda and had documentation to back that up for helping encourage the Sudanese refugees to leave the country. He helped organize their flight to either South Sudan or Sudan. And he was adamant that there was high-level government involvement and that this process basically couldn't have existed without Ugandan officials not just being aware of it, but also participating in it. The question of Israeli complicity is a little bit more difficult to nail down, but these reports have now filtered back to the Israeli administration. They're aware of these claims, and they've really, you know, they claim that they've investigated them, but they've really done nothing to stop this from happening. I mean, this process still continues.
Is this on its face illegal?
That's the key question, and that's where organizations like UNHCR and other human rights groups are looking into it. So on its face, if the asylum seekers were given what they're promised, which is, you know, refugee status in the third country, right to work, and all the other promises are met, then, you know, it seems that this could be a viable system, although you can question the ethics of it. But where it might run afoul of international refugee law is that if these asylum seekers are being forced into situations where they are potentially subject to persecution or death, as has been the case. You know, some of these men have ended up trying to cross the Mediterranean and dying after they've been forced out of Rwanda and Uganda. Some have been captured by ISIS and killed in Libya. Then that would be a violation of non-refoulement, which is an international policy that you can't force asylum seekers or refugees into these kind of situations where they might be persecuted or killed.
Has the Israeli government or the Ugandan government, Rwandan, have any of them responded to your article?
I have not heard from them since publication. Before we went to press, you know, I kind of ran some of the key findings by them to say that this is what we were going to publish. They all deny any kind of involvement. The Israeli government has acknowledged in a court case that they sent agents to look into some of these claims, but they never actually found any evidence of this system taking place, which would seem to indicate that they didn't really scratch too far beneath the surface.
Andrew Green reporting on Israel's system for exporting African migrants to a third country. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
Here in the U.S., Donald Trump has said the so-called Dreamers can stay for now. But these undocumented immigrants who came here as kids don't feel so secure. They have temporary protection from deportation under the DACA program started by President Obama. But no one knows how long that will last. And some of them aren't waiting around to find out. My BBC colleague Will Grant met some DACA recipients who are now back in Mexico and trying to make a fresh start.
My name is Angelica Mitre, and I'm currently a dreamer here in Mexico.
Angelica, or Angie, moved back to Mexico when her father was deported. From being the new girl in the class who spoke no English when she moved to the US, she's again found herself as a foreigner back in her home country, too.
I've always been really, really passionate about school. But being there in the States, I knew that I wasn't going to be able to do a college career or have a college degree because I was not a U.S. citizen. Here in Mexico, we have to look for the opportunities. It's not as easy as over there. You have to literally fight for a space in a college. You just don't get out of high school and be like, okay, I have a college. No, you do an exam. A lot of teenagers do not make it in, so they just start working. And that's how our education in Mexico goes lower and lower and lower.
Our vision is to prove that the American dream can also be accomplished in Mexico, and also to let the entire world know that this is a humanitarian crisis.
Israel Concha is one of the event organizers. A returnee himself, he founded a non-profit organization called New Comienzos, Spanglish for New Starts, to provide a support network for people who were going through what he did.
I still remember that day. At that moment, when I was at the border with Mexico, at the international bridge, where I could actually see where Mexico started, for some reason, I just started tearing, you know. My hopes, my dreams, my entire life. I thought the U.S. was also my country. Pretty much, they kicked me out just like a criminal.
Beyond the emotional upheaval, the biggest problem for deportees, says Israel, is negotiating Mexico's tangled bureaucracy. This is where New Comienzos tries to come in.
We created this interactive system that looks for specific keywords throughout the internet. For example, repatriated, bilingual, need a job, need assistance. And automatically this system connects with the people that need these services.
They don't know their rights, and they think that as long as they are undocumented people, they don't have rights, and they do.
Eunice Rendon has worked for successive administrations on immigrant issues and is one of the deportees' top political allies. She says most still don't know their entitlements on both sides of the border.
So we have to make them aware of that. A little problem or a little mistake can have very big consequences.
One man who knows just how big those consequences can be is Francisco Juarez. Deported after 14 years living in Kentucky, he says he was arrested for trespassing when he was just taking a shortcut home through a parking lot.
Because I was in the United States for 14 years.
In Kentucky, Francisco had set up his own theater company and had had plays performed by local directors. Now he's living with his father again in the Mexican state of Morelos.
It's difficult because it's starting from zero. When I was in the United States, I just had to wait 2 days to get a job. And here I have 3 months just to get the papers to work.
Francisco Juarez there, ending that report from the BBC's Will Grant in Mexico City. If you want to beat back the climate crisis, you've got to get vehicles off of fossil fuels. It'll be a while before that happens, but the car industry just got a big push in that direction with this week's announcement from Volvo. The Swedish-based and Chinese-owned company has just announced that starting in 2019, all of its new car models will be electric or hybrid. Greg Archer is the director of clean vehicles at the Transport and Environment Think Tank. Greg, how important is this?
Oh, this is a very significant announcement. Volvo at the moment sell 80% of their vehicles as diesel, and they're clearly sending a very strong message that in the future it's going to be electric.
Electric cars still have some major disadvantages compared to traditional engines. There's a limited distance they can go before needing recharging. They need a place to recharge. Is there any way these problems can be overcome?
They're being overcome all the time. I mean, Volvo's new generation of battery cars will have a much longer range of around 400 kilometers. So people won't need to worry in the same way that their car is going to run out of juice in a short time.
What percentage of auto sales globally are electric currently?
Globally, the figure is around 1-2%. That has grown very significantly in the last 2 or 3 years. And many companies are forecasting much higher levels by 2025. For example, the Volkswagen Group has said it expects a quarter of its cars to be electric by that time. Daimler has indicated around 20%, BMW 15-20%.
What impact, if any, do you think that this announcement will have on the U.S. market?
I think it will be a shock in the U.S. market. I think in many ways, U.S. manufacturers seem to be going backwards in relation to both producing more fuel-efficient and indeed electric vehicles. And I think this is a wake-up that the rest of the world is clearly moving in this direction. And if Detroit doesn't do the same thing, then it's going to run into problems in the future as it has in the past by failing to invest in new technology.
There's much more pressure for electric vehicles in a place like Scandinavia because the costs of running combustion engines are much higher. Isn't that true?
That's certainly the case. And with the low gas prices in the US, there is less benefit from electric vehicles. But even there, the price of batteries is falling now so sharply that it will become more cost effective, even in the US, to drive an electric car over a conventional gasoline vehicle.
What about the charging infrastructure?
Charging infrastructure is certainly expanding in China and Europe and to some extent in the US. Particularly fast charging stations along highways are beginning to be introduced that enables electric cars to be used on long trips. But most people will once they have a 400 kilometer range vehicle will simply be able to recharge at their garage at home.
Volvo obviously thinks that electric is the future. Do you think this is the kind of vehicle we'll all be driving in 20 years?
Yeah, I think in 20 years' time, we will have said goodbye to buying internal combustion engines. And I certainly think by 2050, we won't have any more internal combustion engine cars on the road, apart from a few geeks that still want to drive them.
Greg, do you drive an electric car?
I don't at the moment, but I'm hoping very much that my next car will be electric.
Greg Archer is the director of clean vehicles at the Transport and Environment Think Tank. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
Here's something I've always wanted to say on the radio. Rogue Italian cows. Okay, here's the story behind that ridiculous headline. About 6 years ago, some cattle near the city of Genoa got loose. Farmers tried to round them up, but
some of them resisted and they maintained their freedom.
That's University of Genoa biologist Elena Hobart.
Now there's around 6 to 8 animals, or maybe even more, roaming free in our mountains. So the interesting thing will be to see how long they will manage to maintain their freedom.
So far, the Wild Cow Collective, okay, herd, seems to be doing well. Hobart is part of the team that's been studying and documenting the herd.
We're learning about their natural behavior. For example, during the day, they stay in the woods, they stay hidden. And when they're eating, one of the female cows stays alert and basically protects the others. They take turns, and so everyone can eat and stay safe at the same time.
The herd has at least two bulls in it, and that means a new generation of rebel calves is now in the picture. And they seem to be getting along just fine, especially when it comes to eating.
The thing is, cows produce milk once they actually have revealed who to give milk to. So in a natural situation, they are milked by the calves. So naturally, that's what happens. Some species of cows have been selected and bred to produce more milk than others. But these cows in particular, they've been bred for meat and not for milk.
But don't think it's all free-range fun and frolics in an alpine meadow for these cattle.
Our mountains are quite difficult territory. Everything is very steep. There's not much food around. So it's not an easy place to live.
Elena Hobart there. She's part of a University of Genoa team that's studying a herd of cows gone wild in Italy. Finally today, a bit of relief from high-stakes geopolitics and rogue cows. Here's a story about a newfangled percussion instrument with a passionate following around the world. It's called the handpan. Amanda Kersey got curious and went along to a group lesson in Berlin recently.
Welcome, everyone. Good to see you all.
Ukrainian musician Zhenya Topov teaches handpan now, but remembers how mysterious the instrument seemed the first time he saw it.
I was very much like, what is that thing? I need this in my life, you know?
On this afternoon, there are five students, all millennials, in his workshop in Berlin. They've kicked off their shoes and are sitting on the floor in a circle, around objects that look as if they've landed from outer space.
People always say the same thing, you know? Oh, it's a UFO! Or, is that a wok? You know, can you cook in that thing? Sometimes like, it's a turtle shell, especially when you're a kid. Yeah. Are you a mutant ninja turtle?
Wok, turtle shell, or maybe a steel drum popped out. But instead of using mallets, you play with your hands on the sheet metal top. It has between 7 and 11 notes. They're a ring of shallow dimples, the lowest note a dome in the center.
Secret spots in the instrument. Every note has harmonics as well. There are things you can do to mess around with the sound a bit.
Dobov passes each student a handpan, weighing about 10 pounds, to put in their cross-legged laps, like a yoga hip stretch. Keep the arms loose, he says, and strike with only one fingertip at a time.
So put your hands on the instrument, just go for it, let it fall.
Luding Pan from China is mesmerized.
It reminds me a lot of the mountains and rivers and nature. And that's also the reason why I love it and want to learn it.
If that comes off a bit culty, it's because handpan has a following. The original was invented by two Swiss artists in 2000 and quickly went from obscurity to coveted object, like the Birkin bag of World Music Society. But it's easier to get a handpan than it used to be. There are at least 140 craftspeople working everywhere, from Argentina to California.
So the instrument is kind of exploding at the moment.
Part of the universal appeal is that, according to makers and musicians, anybody can play it.
It's expressive of you. There is, however, resonance. Resonance. You hit it, you strike a tone field, and it resonates, right? Or there is dampness. So we want to be able to articulate this.
Jeremy Bugetti from France takes a solo. He's brought his own handpan to class. He searched the world for years before getting it. He wrote letters to the Swiss inventors. No answer. Emailed a Russian maker. Nothing. Then one from Ukraine put him on a waiting list. 18 months and a few thousand dollars later, Bugetti owned a handpan.
You never know. It's kind of luck. I mean, if you really want it, you get it. What I like with this instrument is it teaches you to be patient, to really not freak out. Like, you don't get it like that.
As you can hear, Bugetti's not a beginner, but the rest of the students are, so it's back to the basics.
It really touches something, and it
creates this incredible kind of atmosphere.
Jessica Kokrow from Germany is starting to get how to move her hands to create the sound she wants. The tone of the handpan she's playing is one of a kind. Every instrument is custom, with different kinds of steel, finishes, and tuning. And they're fun to play with other people. Thopov shows how it's done.
And then the other person. Or this thing, right? So you can explore all these techniques, or you can do whatever you want. All right?
Finally, a jam session, two at a time. Is over, and the handpan a little less alien spacecraft after a close encounter of the musical kind. For The World, Amanda Kersey, Berlin.
We leave you with a little handpan. You can see these strange musical objects and the blissed out millennials learning to play them at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. See you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.